My name is Erin O'Brien, and I'm the membership editor at War on the Rocks. This is The Insider, the members-only podcast where we ask War on the Rocks authors to reflect on their articles and why they matter for national security. Today, I'm joined by Harry Stevens, author of Strangers in the Motherland, The Dynamics of Russia's Foreign Recruitment. Harry is a graduate of the University of Chicago who specializes in Russian affairs and defense economics and conducts research with the Center for the National Interest. Welcome to The Insider.
Hi, thanks for having me. Great to be back.
So as always, I thought we could start off the podcast by talking a little bit about your core argument in this piece. I mean, in this article, you look at Russia's foreign military recruitment strategy, where it's happening, how it's happening, why it's happening. Could you start off by telling us just a little bit more about the crux of your argument?
Part of the article is really just doing a more in-depth look at some of the major hotspots for Russian recruiting, but that's in support of an argument which goes that these recruiting efforts are probably being driven more by provincial governments, in Russian terms, we'd say the oblast level, rather than the Kremlin. And so to prove this, I look at explicit examples. So for instance, there was a recruiting campaign that was linked directly back to the government of the Sakhalin Republic, which is a province in Russia, as well as looking at indirect examples, such as examining the incentive structure and finding that provincial governments especially have the most incentive to set up these kind of things because they're most concerned about losing their labor force to conscription. And they're much more sensitive to that than the federal government, which can often kind of think of the population on aggregate rather than being so worried about individuals. And I use individual examples of recruiting to support that.
So why don't you tell us a little bit more about these examples? I mean, I know in the piece you talk about Cuba, you talk about India, and you talk about Nepal. What do these recruitment strategies look like there? And also, how are these local governments forming ties with people in these countries?
In the individual country, so of course, in the majority of countries, recruiting for another army, a foreign military, is illegal. Or if it's not illegal, strictly, it's highly frowned upon in an illegal gray area. So in almost all these countries I looked at, with the exception of maybe Syria, they're not outright in the street saying like, hey, come join the Russian military. A lot of times they're acting covertly and sometimes they're even deceiving the people they're recruiting. So that's in the Indian example. So they'll oftentimes work through normal kind of labor recruiters. And so people will either join and then they'll kind of later learn that, oh, you're actually going to be a soldier, or they're told that they're going to be a regular, you know, regular worker in a factory somewhere in, you know, somewhere in Russia. And later it turns out they get flown and driven to a training center. And so they're kind of bamboozled in that way. And that's what we see most frequently in India, maybe in Cuba, but it's a little weird there. And so one of the things I wanted to discuss in the article was with Cuba, because Cuba was an interesting case whereby officially the Cuban government is claiming that Russian recruiting operations are human trafficking, basically, where they, like I said, where they're pretending that they're recruiting for civilian purposes, but they're actually tricking these people and they're, you know, sending them off to be in soldiers. But a lot of the behavior of the soldiers themselves, like the Cubans who are allegedly being trafficked, doesn't really fit in with that. They and their family are making Facebook posts, my son is going off to the fight, we're proud of him, or they're posting on Facebook and other social media apps during their time there, which to me, I think, and I think most people would not, it's not really congruous with someone who's being trafficked. And so I kind of theorize that the Cuban government may have turned a blind eye or maybe benefiting in some way from this arrangement. And because they didn't want, and if they were caught, they kind of turned it into alleging a human trafficking operation in order to avoid being sanctioned or generally being associated with Russia's war effort.
And I'm curious, I mean, where is this idea coming from? Is this something that is being filtered down from the Kremlin as a strategy to recruit fighters into the war in Ukraine? Or are these just kind of provinces taking initiative here?
I would estimate that it is the provinces, the local governments that are really taking the initiative here. So in my estimation, they have the most incentive to, because especially these more sparsely populated provinces, you know, post-Soviet collapse, a lot of the provinces in Russia have really been hollowed out as the birth rate declines and people move to major cities. these are provinces that really can't spare the type of losses that soldiers are undertaking in Ukraine are devastating to the populations. And poorer provinces are suffering especially. So I would be unsurprised, and I think I would expect, that it is these provinces that are coming up with the idea and are going through with it to try and get this recruitment. And my theory is that this foreign recruitment, you know, if you recruit 100 guys from Nepal or 50 guys from Cuba, those numbers are going to be counted against the recruiting quotas for the province. So instead of recruiting 300 guys, now you only have to recruit 150. And if you're a small province in Russia, we only have 1 million people, that number may be, make a huge difference. It may mean that certain businesses or a factory or a hospital can stay open instead of having to shut down. And to me, I think that also explains why some of these operations, we talked about how the Indian operation was legitimately run like a human trafficking scheme. And to me, that didn't make any sense that the Kremlin would run it that way. The Kremlin, the Kremlin is, of course, not as competent as we thought before the beginning of the Ukrainian invasion, but India is maybe, with the exception of China, Russia's most valuable partner. So it would seem odd to me that for what amounts to maybe 1,000 men, maybe a little less, that Russia would risk damaging its relationship with India, who is its second largest oil purchaser and is an important partner. So to me, it seems more likely that a province was behind these kind of schemes, because for them, 1,000 men is a big deal. So based on that information, I think that the impetus is really coming from the bottom up on this. They're coming to the Kremlin and saying, hey, can we do this? Because they really can't afford to be sending, these loss rates are unsustainable.
And so now I want to look a little bit at the role that these soldiers play when they actually get to the battlefield. I mean, if this is being operated a bit like a human trafficking operation, these aren't highly skilled or technical soldiers. I mean, what role are they playing here? How are they being used? And it's a bit of a grim question, but at what rates are they dying?
So as you said, certainly these are not elite soldiers. Some of them seem to have, like, you know, some military experience. Like you hear about, you know, Cuba oftentimes, some of them had military experience, but for the most part, these are just regular people. So we don't have a whole lot of information about what rate they're being sent to the front line versus back, but almost all the descriptions you read about in the journalistic and NGO reports have them at the front and not support personnel. Most of them seem to have specialized skills that would give them a status. The loss rates, I would have to say they're probably at least as high as you're seeing for the standard Russian infantrymen, if not, you know, maybe higher. I don't have evidence that their ethnicity is causing them to be thrown away. I don't have any evidence of that. But historically, we do see that there is, in the Russian military, the treatment of, for instance, non-ethnically Russian units, there's considered to be less consideration for their safety. So I think it'd be a fair assumption that units that aren't even from Russia at all, soldiers aren't even from Russia at all, are going to be treated similarly, if not slightly worse.
And what about the backlash in these countries? I mean, of course, in Russia, in these kind of far off provinces where many soldiers are being recruited from, we've seen pushback from mothers, from girlfriends, especially to their recruitment and often death. Have we seen any similar kind of reaction in these countries where these foreign fighters are being recruited from?
Yeah, absolutely. So when these schemes get found out, there is a lot of pushback from, of course, the first people to always notice are, as you said, the mothers, the wives, girlfriends, the families. But it becomes a really hot button political issue whenever they're discovered, because, of course, one, no government likes to see their kind of young men go and die in some foreign war, but also because it makes the country look quite bad, threatens kind of the appearance of sovereignty or of kind of control. And it also, for some countries, it could appear to implicate them in Russia's war in Ukraine. There's certainly been pushback. So in Nepal, where these things were discovered and seemed to be one of the largest sources of recruitment, these schemes were shut down. In India, it became a national issue. And the kind of when Modi, back a month or two ago, went to meet with Putin, it was kind of the issue that the first thing he addressed, like, you know, bringing these troops home. And then, of course, in Cuba, you know, maybe not for the exact right reasons, so to speak, but they did shut down these operations, and they've prosecuted the people who are associated with them. So it always inspires a big backlash, albeit, of course, for for different reasons.
And if these operations are getting shut down in these countries that were kind of hotspots for foreign recruitment, where are you seeing these operations shift now? Because presumably these provinces or Russia more broadly still needs fighters.
In some places, there's going to be a continued recruitment effort, though it may be lower profile or lower numbers. In some places, I'm sure it's impacted completely. I'd be very surprised if, for instance, India, because of its political importance to Russia, I'd be very surprised if India is a continuing target for large-scale recruitment. One of the places I mentioned, though, in the article is Syria, which, of course, there's, you know, Syrian government is very closely associated with Russia. I have no doubt going to continue to recruit there to the extent they can. Otherwise, yeah, I think in places like Nepal, India, they're going to shift away from those countries and towards countries that are just more amenable to whether that's a more friendly friendlier government, or whether it's just places where the government isn't as present. So, you know, in the article, I think I speculate that you're really looking for countries with a dearth of money and a surplus of soldiers, you know, a surplus of kind of young men who have military experience or at least don't have jobs. And so maybe you're looking at certain African countries. Russia has made inroads in parts of the Sahel region. And so you might be looking at places, you know, Niger and Chad. But you also just might see kind of, if we imagine that the Russian efforts had been centralized around a set of countries, they might just become more decentralized. And, you know, you pick up 500 guys there, 500 guys here. One also interesting thing to consider is if the Kremlin has or will step in to ensure these operations have more diplomatic cover. As we discussed, Cuba and India, there's you know, evidence that these provinces were kind of doing their own thing without much regard for the diplomatic blowback it could have if discovered. The Kremlin may decide to step in a little bit and, you know, lend some of its prestige and, you know, its contacts that your average provincial official in, you know, Nizhny Novgorod or somewhere doesn't really have access to.
Right. And this also, correct me if I'm wrong, seems to create an opening for the United States and its allies, right? Like, if foreign recruitment by Russia in most of these countries is illegal, could countries opposing Russia step in and try to shut down these operations more proactively, let's say?
Yeah, I think this is a good opportunity for the U.S. and allied countries to kind of build a strong consensus around a certain an issue, right? It's like pretty much, you know, the vast majority of countries, if, you know, if you ask the governments, would say, yeah, we don't think that basically what is mercenaries, foreign recruiting, should be legal or practiced. And you can even get countries which are probably otherwise hesitant to directly condemn Russia to agree to this principle. And so currently, foreign recruiting probably only accounts for a relatively small percentage of total Russian recruitment. The large majority of Russian troops or troops fighting for Russia are still recruited in Russia. However, at a time when the casualty rate is so high for Russia, even the loss of, you know, whatever, 5% of recruiting could be significant. So I think that there is an opportunity for the international community, you know, and the U.S., EU, and allies to kind of make a clear message, if they haven't already, to some of these kind of vulnerable countries and say, hey, you know, we know you don't want your men going off to do this. We don't want that either. You know, we don't want you looking like you might support Russia. Therefore, well, let's, like, you know, take steps to kind of make sure that we're curbing any potential recruitment here, you know, monitoring labor recruitment networks for this kind of thing, et cetera, et cetera. And it does have the potential to deprive Russia of a non-trivial amount of manpower. So it definitely is an opportunity for to make things more difficult for the Russians.
Right. And in the last couple of minutes we have here, I want to focus on something that really caught my attention when I was reading the piece, because you're talking here about a lot of Russian soldiers coming from far-off provinces and then fighters coming from very, very different parts of the world where very, very different languages are spoken. And of course, communication is so key on the battlefield and achieving cohesion in a unit. How are these fighters actually being integrated into these Russian units? And do you have any sense of kind of what the social life, for lack of a better word, is for these soldiers?
Yeah. So in terms of language, of course, the vast majority of these foreign troops don't know a word of Russian when they come in. You know, obviously, if you come from Nepal or India, you know, you're not going to speak Russian, odds are. So some of the troops, so one of the sources I mentioned was Central Asians. So that's, you know, from kind of the former Central Asian SSRs. They usually speak Russian, but they make up probably a small portion, in my estimation, of the total. A lot of times it's mentioned that these, for language, these troops will receive some sort of language training, some sort of crash course in Russian. So I'm sure their basic communication isn't that much of a problem. However, the units don't seem to be, there doesn't seem to be like specifically like foreign units. So like they're kind of thrown in with the Russian units. I have no doubt that the, based on some of the reports I read from, you know, soldiers who are sending letters or, you know, emails back, the social life does not seem to be very pleasant, of course. You know, the xenophobia, the problem in Russia, communication can also be difficult for some of the more advanced people. You know, some of the recruits reported that they were given, you know, a few weeks of language training, some said a few months. So I know Russian, and I can tell you if you put me with a bunch of native Russian speakers after only learning it for 3 or 4 weeks, that'd be real rough. So I have no doubt it's like a pretty hostile experience when you count between kind of just the fear of being in this new dangerous place and some of the xenophobia that exists in Russia.
And finally, do you expect these operations to expand at all? I mean, as Russia continues to suffer losses in Ukraine, for example?
Yes, I expect these operations to expand so long as the international situation is permissible to it. So that is to say, if Russia can find countries that are targets for this recruitment, I expect this to continue because the Russian, as key issue is in Russia, is increasingly a lack of manpower sufficient to both, you know, as I say, to like fill the factories and to fill the front lines. Russia is currently in a manpower deficit that's estimated to be about, domestically, the economy is about 5 million workers short. And that is including in like the defense industry. And so, and it's also cheaper to hire a foreign soldier, likely. Sometimes they're paid lower wages. Sometimes it's much less likely. It seems they receive the extensive death and or injury benefits. So between those economic reasons, Russia will have incentive to continue to expand these operations if they find vulnerable countries and if the international community can't take sufficient steps to kind of prevent the formation of these networks or the reformation of these networks.
All right. Well, thank you so much for coming on The Insider to discuss this and for writing this piece for War on the Rocks.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.